You're listening to the Diplomat's Asia Geopolitics Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, now back in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Katie Putz, your co-host, and I am also returned to Washington.
Back in the eye of the hurricane, so to speak, Katie. How are you doing?
Yes, indeed. Well, I've got a great tan, but it's not going to do me much good.
That's right. So as listeners will understand, the biggest geopolitical story of global relevance continues to be the transformation of the United States, which I would argue is in the course of not just relitigating its foreign policy. We can all understand that the Trump administration's approach to global affairs is very different from the Biden administration. But I think in a deeper way, the United States, I think for the first time in essentially 80 years, is beginning to express a new grand strategy. And that, I think, is something very much worthy of discussion on this podcast, even if the implications for Asia aren't at the forefront of that all the whole time. I think the place that Katie and I were thinking of starting today is the American Vice President J.D. Vance's speech at the Munich Security Conference. We'll also follow up a little bit on the high-level U.S.-Russia interactions that have taken place since then. We had the first meeting of the Secretaries of State, the Secretary of State and the Russian Foreign Minister since the start of the Ukraine war. So, Katie, why don't we begin there? J.D. Vance's speech, what was your reaction?
You know, it was as if it was broadcast from a different universe. I think that speech, there was a lot in that speech, but to me, one of the, and not just to me, but to many people, the one of the more shocking sort of things that he said, and I think this is relevant to Asia, is, you know, he says that the threat that I worry the most about vis-a-vis Europe is not Russia, it's not China, it's not any other external actor. The threat is from within, the retreat of Europe from some of its most fundamental values, values shared with the United States of America. And then he follows that up with sort of a cherry-picked list of events over the last couple of years, one of which was, and this is outside of our region of coverage, but one of which was the a recently annulled election in Romania, which is in itself an unprecedented event. But he sort of lays these out without context. In the Romanian example, for example, the Romanian intelligence services had exposed evidence of voter manipulation, illegal campaign finance, cyber attacks, suspected Russian interference. And so to have an American sort of say that this is censorship, this is Soviet-style censorship, when a European country is saying our elections are being interfered with, is very weird. It was very sort of strange. And I think that context matters because we do live in a world where there is so much information available, and it is really easy to manipulate information and manipulate people with information. And I think dismissing that as a possibility bodes very ill. I think it's worth noting that J.D. Vance, to my knowledge, has never acknowledged that Donald Trump lost the 2020 election, for example, which is a piece of arguably disinformation. And so, you know, Vance characterizing mis and disinformation as effectively made up problems is not a good signal, you know, and he couches all of this in these terms about democracy. But it's just it was very strange. It was a very bizarre speech to me. And I think the European reaction to it, I think, mirrors how my reaction to it, which is this is kind of a scary statement to be hearing from an American in Europe.
Yeah. So, you know, since the speech, I think you've seen many of the prominent opinion pages in European newspapers begin to talk about the United States essentially transforming into an adversary. Right. I think that gets back into that opening argument that I offered about the U.S. shifting its grand strategy. I think Vance's speech, what I think most Europeans found fundamentally disturbing was, you know, the cornerstone of alliances is the idea of political solidarity fundamentally. And in the post-war context, that's really been, you know, we criticize the United States sort of being somewhat cynical in the ways in which it talks about democracy and democracy overseas, but at least in the transatlantic context, and even arguably in East Asia, especially in the post-Cold War era after you get democratization in South Korea, democratic values and sort of solidarity do actually matter for the window dressing, at least, around alliances and the case for why allies have shared interests against authoritarian leaders. Vance did the exact opposite, which was that he painted a picture of a United States that identified more with essentially a transnational network of far-right leaders, to include Vladimir Putin in Russia. This was, of course, compounded by the president himself, who went on to call Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine a dictator, without Vance or Trump criticizing Putin, who I think is pretty fairly characterized as a dictator. And then, of course, we get the first meeting between the Secretary of State and the Russian foreign minister since the start of the Ukraine war, indicating a plan to essentially re-architect not only the United States' geopolitical relationship to the European continent and to its NATO allies, but to the Russian Federation. And so there is geopolitical logic here. It's a logic that I think doesn't make sense to longstanding observers of U.S. foreign policy. But that's the reason I do think that this is evidence of the U.S., I think, making a really, really big turn in its grand strategy. And there's all, and you know, grand strategy does involve all elements of national power. And I think if you pull in what the Trump administration has been doing on the economic front with tariffs, you bring in the broader dismissal of alliances and extended deterrence, you start to get a pretty coherent picture of the United States essentially making a sharp 180-degree turn from a lot of what it's been doing for the last 180 years. And that's different from, you know, I don't want to be ahistorical. Like, we have had difficulties with allies in the past, invasion of Iraq, the Guam Doctrine under Nixon, Jimmy Carter threatening to pull troops out of Korea, 1960s assurance crises in Europe in the NATO context. But none of that was caused by the fundamental variable that I think that's at play now in Washington. But, I mean, these are still early days. There are still contradictions. I would even extend the argument to really go as far as to say that great power competition, as I think many Americans have been talking about it since the first Trump administration, no longer really is a useful describer of what the United States is trying to do. And maybe we can interrogate that a bit more.
Yeah, you know, I think that sort of repositioning is what's going on. One thing I want to highlight that you mentioned that is worth saying again is there is a degree of coherence to this, even while there are contradictions. But that coherence is a 180 turn. We're going back sort of a completely opposite direction. And we said this in a previous podcast, but, you know, the U.S. administration is parroting language of longtime U.S. adversaries now. And that is kind of troubling. And then I think beyond that observation is, you know, arguably American allies in Asia are watching how Washington is treating and dealing with its allies in Europe. And it's sort of a hint of the kind of treatment they might expect. You know, if you have sort of these long-term trend lines being reversed, you know, what is it that Japan and Korea can expect? It is worth mentioning here that on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference, the Japan-US ROK foreign ministers meeting happened. And there wasn't a whole bunch of news from that. There was a very short statement thereafter. But that is sort of a piece of continuity in terms of that relationship. They're at least meeting. But where that leads on a longer term, we'll see. Did you have any thoughts about sort of the Japanese and the Korean presence at Munich? I feel like in the past, over the past couple of years, when China was a big focus, there was more of a focus of Europe on Asia in that question. And that, I think, was absent from this year.
Yeah. So, you know, just on without getting too much into Munich specifically, I would say the Asian piece of all of this is interesting because in a way, the shoe hasn't yet dropped for Asia, right? The administration has its sights kind of zeroed in on European allies who, according to J.D. Vance, don't have freedom of speech or any freedoms, and they're all terrible authoritarians, while Vladimir Putin's a great leader who deserves American embrace. In Asia, I mean, you have a very different kind of political context, right? I would argue that there are other sources of misgivings in Asia. Trump's longstanding view of transactional alliances, his grievance going all the way back to the 1980s about Japan fundamentally being a country that takes advantage of the United States, which he's repeated. Australia is interesting. Richard Marles, the Australian defense minister, had a pretty good meeting with Pete Hegseth, the American Secretary of Defense, on AUKUS, which I know was a huge source of concern, the continuity there for the Australians. So in a way, if you're in Asia and you're looking at this and you're extremely optimistic, right, you can tell yourself a story that, you know, we've been talking about the United States pivoting to Asia since the first term of the Obama administration. And the big inhibitor to that was the U.S. getting drawn into crises in the Middle East, staying in Afghanistan way too long, getting drawn into European wars and crises. What we've seen in the first 30 to 40 days of the Trump administration is evidence that the U.S. is letting go a lot of that. And this, I think, gets back to the big geopolitical question about, you know, what is the Trump administration doing? I mean, is this part of what many on the American right have been talking about for the last few years, which is an attempt to pull the so-called reverse Kissinger, right? Reflecting the idea that, like the United States, like Nixon going to China at the height of the Cold War and aligning the United States with China, essentially, or at least mollifying that relationship to focus on competition with the Soviet Union, today the Trump administration is trying to pull Russia away from China. Now, there's a big problem with that agreement argument, which is that the history doesn't even, first of all, the history is not repeating itself. It also just doesn't rhyme. During the Sino-Soviet split, you had a Sino-Soviet split, which is the point I was going to make, right, in the late 1960s. It wasn't that the United States, with Nixon's great brilliance and Kissinger's great brilliance, showed up in China and convinced Mao that China's better off normalizing with the United States by the end of the 1970s. It was that you had a Sino-Soviet split, you had China and the Soviet Union fight a war in 1969, a war that almost went nuclear, by the way, and that creates the conditions for Kissinger to kind of show up and be like, hey, these guys aren't getting along very well. And if you look at the Sino-Russian relationship today, it is the complete opposite, right? And you've had a high-level expression of solidarity by Xi Jinping for Russia since the Vance speech, since the Rubio-Lavrov meeting in Saudi Arabia. So the conditions just don't seem to exist right now. But in a way, I mean, that's why I make the argument that great power competition isn't really going to be what the administration ends up doing. It's because the broader instinct that I think is at play here is sort of that 19th century Bismarckian approach to geopolitics, where the United States sees other great powers in the international system as worthy of its respect, essentially, while it sort of trods all over smaller countries, multilateral organizations, even medium-sized powers and traditional allies to sort of essentially carry out a broader shift in its grand strategy. So we could be wrong, but that at least seems to be where the evidence is pointing at the moment for me. I don't know. What do you think, Katie?
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on with that. You know, I think there is this, you know, for years we've been talking about great power competition. And it was very clearly the United States and Europe and their allies on one end, and Russia and China and their allies on the other end. And we see sort of a reshuffling of the deck under Donald Trump, in which the United States is sort of now putting its cards with Russia, that sort of direct engagement. And not direct engagement in sort of the pursuit of a peace process involving Ukraine. I think it's really interesting the ways in which Ukraine has been left out of that discussion, even though it's a war in Ukraine. We've had sort of, I forget whose confirmation hearing it was. I think it was a defense undersecretary or something, was asked directly, you know, did Russia invade Ukraine, and would not answer the question, And that is a verifiable fact that Russia invaded Ukraine. And the fact that administration officials won't even say those words is a real pandering to Russia. It's a pandering to Putin and Moscow in pursuit of sort of bridging that relationship at whatever cost. Mm-hmm. Now, where that goes in terms of great power competition in the long term, you know, how stable will that sort of triumvirate be? I don't know. I think some of the things we have to watch for is how sort of the tariff game rolls out with regard to China. If I think the reverse Kissinger thing, I think your point on that is really valid, that Kissinger was exploiting a rift that already existed. That rift does not exist, so you can't really exploit a rift that doesn't exist. So we'll see where that goes. But I think watching how U.S. policy evolves with regard to China as this sort of other hand is dealing with Russia is what is sort of relevant for certainly our audiences in Asia, because I think that also forecasts how the U.S. will approach many of the conflicts and difficulties that Asian countries have with China. If it becomes parallel to how the situation in Europe is rolling out, or if it differentiates from that. So that's one of the things that I'm going to be watching, is how that relationship evolves, because we have not seen as much engagement really between the U.S. and China at this moment as we have between the U.S. and Russia.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a big pointer to flag for our listeners that we'll be watching closely. I'd also note, you know, you had the UN General Assembly vote where the U.S. Voted alongside Russia. I think that's the first time that Washington and Moscow have been on the same side of a prominent UN resolution at the General Assembly on a matter of geopolitical importance since, I think, the Suez Crisis. So really, I mean, and, you know, the Suez Crisis being this kind of pivotal moment for global power shifts away from the French and the Brits at the height of decolonization. So, yeah, I think this is a pretty momentous time, and... You know, we're going to have a lot to talk about in the coming weeks and months. So, again, I hope listeners will be understanding that as analysts based in Washington who think a lot about the U.S. role in Asia, even if what we're talking about isn't directly about events in Asia, the implications and the ripple effects across the broader region that we cover here at the Asia Geopolitics podcast are going to be fairly substantial. And of course, there will be plenty of opportunity to talk about the Trump administration's direct engagements with Asia as those begin to accelerate in the coming weeks. But Katie, I think we'll leave it there. And yeah, we'll be back soon with more. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, always. And in my sort of usual fashion, I'm going to take an opportunity to pitch the Diplomats magazine. We're about to put out our 124th issue, and this month is very relevant. The cover story is going to focus on the new age of global trade, which we have a really wonderful author who outlines sort of how the U.S. and China at the forefront, sort of under the international trade sphere, is undergoing this paradigmatic. Shift away from free trade and towards what he characterizes as aggressive neo-mercantilism. It's a really interesting, I know that sounds super weedy, but it is a really interesting exploration of tariffs and trade wars and sort of what we can expect on trade. The magazine also has a really excellent feature on the status of Central Asia-Russia relations after several years of a lot of change, and then a check-in on Pakistan after a year under Shehbaz Sharif. All very interesting and relevant, and I think there's a lot more in the issue, so please check it out.
Fantastic. Well, as I said, if you want to hear more, make sure you subscribe to future episodes. If you've been a subscriber for a while, but you haven't yet left us a review, please do that. You can do that anywhere you get your podcasts. We do appreciate it quite a bit. And as always, if you have suggestions for us, do reach out to either myself or Katie by email or on social media. We're very happy to take that feedback into account. Thanks a lot for listening. We'll be back soon with more.